This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel news team. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, the Democratic Convention is underway in Philly, but it's still reeling following the release of tens of thousands of DNC emails revealing an organizational bias against Bernie Sanders. We have the latest on hashtag DNC leak.
Also, an update to a story we brought you last week about getting rich off domain squatting. Does Hillary Clinton's pick of Tim Kaine as vice president mean that one lucky resident in the nation's capital will be receiving a hefty windfall? The DC's Rachel Curzius joins us.
And later, the Pentagon did something good last week that could prevent war correspondence from being blown up by the Pentagon. We'll talk in our classified session.
But first, let's talk about that convention where I hear things are going just great to start. Just things are swimmingly going along. Absolutely fantastic. I mean, a day before things were set to kick off, we had the person who was supposed to chair the convention, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, announced she was resigning. She had still planned to gavel in the convention on Monday, but after receiving a chorus of boos from delegates in the morning, she decided she wouldn't even be doing that either. Now, Wasserman Schultz's ouster came, of course, as a result of the DNC email released last week by WikiLeaks. And we read a few of those emails on the show yesterday. There's perhaps the most egregious one featuring the DNC's chief financial officer suggesting to the DNC communications team that someone should highlight Bernie's secular Jewish religion to potentially freak out Baptist voters in the South. There were also the emails showing DNC officials creating a narrative of Bernie's campaign being a complete mess. We had emails of officials calling for inaccurate articles about Bernie to be spread to reporters while also asking that the DNC not be attributed to the spread of these articles. We had the correspondences that tie MSNBC to the DNC with Chuck Todd trying to get tickets to an MSNBC after party for DNC staffers. We also had the DNC and Hillary Clinton apparently providing unattributed information to MSNBC reporters to write articles critical of Bernie Sanders. Again, listen to yesterday's show. We went down the list of a lot of these emails. Some of them haven't even been covered in other outlets yet. By the way, there's tens of thousands of these emails. I expect more and more stories to be coming up as the days go by. And we've got some new stuff for you today. For example, I'm going to posit this theory, Sam Knight. I'm going to suggest that Debbie Wasserman Schultz's resignation following the DNC email leak has less to do with the embarrassing stuff in the emails regarding Bernie Sanders and more to do with the potential that she violated federal election law.
Can it be both?
It can definitely be both, too. That's because these emails reveal that DNC officials may have improperly done work on behalf of Debbie Wasserman Schultz's re-election campaign in her congressional district in South Florida. She's up for re-election in November, as are all the members of the House. And she's facing a challenge from a Bernie Sanders Democrat, I'll say, in Tim Canova. Now, this would be a big no-no in election law. Schultz has her own re-election campaign down in Florida. She also chairs the Democratic National Committee. She's not allowed to use her power at the DNC to boost her re-election chances in Florida, yet email suggests that that was exactly what was happening. One chain includes DNC staffers, including the DNC communications director, Luis Miranda, searching for intelligence on an event in Alaska featuring Schultz's opponent, Tim Canova. There's no way Kay doesn't have someone who can get her intel, Miranda said in an email referring to Kay Brown, the executive director of the Alaska Democratic Party. We need to push them, again, referring to intel on this event in Alaska that Tim Canova is speaking at. Emails also show DNC staffers assisting in distributing Schultz's campaign talking points and also fielding questions from reporters on Tim Canova. Now, all of this has prompted Mr. Canova to prepare to file a complaint with the Federal Elections Commission. Probably as soon as this week, we could see this complaint issued. In a statement, Canova states that, quote, The WikiLeaks emails indicate that Debbie Wasserman Schultz used DNC resources to assist her re-election campaign in violation of federal law. Again, did Debbie Wasserman Schultz resign because her staff at the DNC were being dumb as hell and had a grudge against Bernie? Or did she resign because she broke the law? Or, as Sam Knight suggested, both. Tim Canova goes on to say, quote, according to the emails, top DNC officials used party resources to monitor, respond to, and impede my campaign on numerous occasions. My campaign election lawyers are investigating these circumstances and preparing a complaint against Wasserman Schultz with the Federal Elections Commission. Keep an eye on this race, folks. It's going to be one hell of a proxy war between the Bernie wing and the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, despite this appearance of unity at the convention, which, given what we've seen so far in day one, hasn't been too united.
Yeah, there was even one email showing how this could have already impacted national congressional races, at least specifically Wasserman Schultz's vendetta with Tim Canova and how it spilled over to the DNC. Wasserman Schultz's office, for example, downplayed Brand New Congress, a political action committee founded by Bernie supporters, because a guy behind it, Zach Exley, was working with Canova. One DNC staffer sent around Exley's message, which the meat of it was basically as follows, quote, some of us Bernie volunteers and former staff have been talking about a campaign that would be big enough and worthwhile enough to keep the revolution going once Bernie is in office. We believe the best way to achieve this is to elect a brand new Congress in 2018. Now, of course, you know, while Bernie is in office may have been a bit optimistic, but the point is clear here to channel some of the pro-Bernie sentiment and put it towards a congressional campaign. The staffer who sent this around called Exley, quote, one of the most effective national volunteer organizers in the country and made a huge impact, that's my editorial thing, huge impact on Bernie's campaign to mobilize his base.
Seems like a good idea. Seems like something that the DNC could get behind. Use excitement among newly Democratic voters who have been drawn to the party by Bernie in an effort to elect down ballot candidates for Congress.
Indeed, it does sound very logical. However, this suggestion was rebuked by Kate Houghton, an aide to Wasserman Schultz, who said, quote, just a reminder that he's part of Tim Canova's campaign team.
In other words, we can't work with him.
So it's good to see Debbie Wasserman Schultz's squabbles have gotten in the way of, you know, one progressive nationwide organization that would benefit the Democratic Party. But hey,
now let's not feel too bad about Congresswoman Schultz losing her post as chairwoman of the DNC.
Yeah, don't worry about
that.
She
promptly landed a gig at the Clinton campaign following her announcement of her resignation at the DNC. Even though it's an honorary position, it still shows that the Clinton campaign is interested in uniting the party by bringing in the one person that the Sanders wing hates more than anyone else into the fold. Also worth mentioning that the person tapped to temporarily replace Schultz as the head of the DNC, Democratic strategist Donna Brazile, is no fan of Bernie either. In one of the released DNC emails, Brazile talks about how she wants to cuss out the Sanders campaign. Be fair, though, Brazile wasn't working at the DNC at the time, so really she's free to say whatever. Now, there's a lot of different reactions to this story of the DNC email leak, and we kind of want to touch on these different reactions. We've got what's coming out of the Sanders camp and fellow Sanders supporters, which is basically, yeah, we knew this all along. It's nice to have proof now. We should clean house at the DNC. It's corrupt, but look, this was all stuff that is largely unsurprising to us. Then there's the reaction coming from Republicans like the RNC chairman, Rance Priebus, who's gleefully going on every cable news channel he can this morning to boast about how the RNC wasn't hacked, that they have better security on their information systems, unlike the Democrats who don't know how to handle their email properly. That was a dig both at the hack and I think at emails, Hillary Clinton's mishandling of email information.
Rance wants to keep that one in the news.
And really, and Rance also made sure to comment that what the emails actually show is very troubling, and that if his emails were hacked, you wouldn't see him plotting against a candidate. And honestly, I'd like to challenge him on that.
I'm really curious
to see what Rance's emails were about Donald Trump back in 2015. So Then there's this other reaction, this third reaction, and this is from Clinton supporters and the Clinton campaign and the Democratic establishment and liberal journalists who've commented on this issue. And I think it's best summed up right here by the Clinton campaign manager himself, Robbie Mook. Take a listen.
All we know right now is what experts are telling us. And what the experts said when this breach initially happened at the DNC was that they believed that it was Russian state actors who took these emails. And what further experts are saying, and again, I refer you to the reporting on this, what further experts are saying is that then because they possessed those emails, that Russian state actors were feeding the emails to hackers for the purpose of helping Donald Trump.
For the purpose of helping Donald Trump. In other words, pay no attention to the actual content of the emails. This is merely Russia trying to get Trump elected. Okay, so a little disclosure here. The show is currently being produced out of the Radio Sputnik studios, which is financed by the Russian government, and we receive compensation for producing this show. So listeners are more than welcome to react to what we have to say skeptically, but I believe that our analysis of this story and the claims being made about it can stand up to scrutiny here. And let me also say that we don't want Trump to win at all. We endorsed Bernie Sanders during the primary, but we will not support Trump, nor will we shirk away from criticizing Clinton. We intend to criticize both candidates, who are the two most unpopular candidates to ever run for office in U.S. history, just in case Politico decides to write a story on this upcoming rant here. So let's talk about these claims of the Russians being behind this leak. First up, there's very little hard evidence that's been offered thus far to determine attribution for the hack of the DNC. Now, in June, the Washington Post broke news of the cyber intrusion at the DNC and quoted DNC officials and a security firm, CrowdStrike, who claimed it was Russian secret services behind the attack. But in the intervening month, the FBI and other law enforcement agencies haven't offered any evidence to back the claims that were being made by DNC officials and private security companies up. The Daily Beast claimed on Monday, though, that, quote, the theory that Moscow orchestrated the leaks to help Trump is fast gaining currency within the Obama administration because of the timing of the leaks and Trump's own connections to the Russian government. The sources said on condition of anonymity because the investigation is ongoing and developing quickly. Now, Moscow denies this, as they would, but stepping in to claim credit for the leak is a hacker named Guccifer 2.0, who shared some of the DNC documents online before WikiLeaks and also turned over some DNC emails to other news outlets, including The Hill. And Guccifer claims he's Eastern European, that he's not affiliated with Russia. And it's important to note that the original Washington Post article attributing the Russians to the DNC hack makes two important points. Although they said that the security researchers discovered intrusions by two different entities, alleged to be competing groups within the Russian FSB known as Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, the Post adds that analysts don't have hard evidence that Guccifer 2.0 is in fact part of one of the Russian groups who hacked the DNC, and quote, it is also possible, researchers said, that someone else besides the Russians were inside the DNC's network and had access to the same documents. Let me just also say that the discovery of metadata on the documents that's written in Cyrillic also doesn't mean that the Russian government and Vladimir Putin are responsible for the hacks either.
True.
Lots of people use Cyrillic around the world.
That's true. And indeed. And I just wanted to explore one of the released emails, which appears to have encouraged the DNC to forcefully claim the Russians are behind all of this and, you know, it is impacting the narrative. On May 3rd, a DNC opposition researcher named Ali Chalupa said she was getting notifications from Yahoo alerting her she was the, quote, target of state-sponsored actors. She writes, since I started digging into Manafort, these messages have been a daily occurrence on my Yahoo account, despite changing my password often. Now, this is, of course, a reference to Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, who worked for Viktor Yanukovych, the former president of Ukraine and an ally of Vladimir Putin. According to national security reporter Michael Isikoff, it was the email that fueled the allegations of the Russian hack and, you know, helped DNC officials cement their alleged certainty. Reading now from Isikoff's article, after Chalupa sent the email to Miranda, which mentions that she had invited this reporter to a meeting with Ukrainian journalists in Washington, it triggered high-level concerns within the DNC, given the sensitive nature of her work. That's when we knew it was the Russians, said a Democratic Party source who has knowledge of the internal probe into the hacked emails. Now, this could very well be true. Again, it could be true that Russian hackers have targeted the DNC, taken their info, and deliberately passed it on to WikiLeaks. And again, we encourage our listeners to check as many sources on this and to, you know, question us. Feel free to discount what we might say. But there's something funny about this email apparently sparking concerns about Russian involvement. If Isikoff is to be believed, number one, the Trump Manafort Russia angle, whether true or not, it was going to come out as part of a Democratic opposition research dump, meaning the DNC was ready to use it against Trump.
And number two?
From number two, just because you get a Yahoo message about state-sponsored hacking doesn't mean it has for sure happened. This is from a Tech Times article on the notifications. Yahoo stresses that a warning message does not imply that an account was compromised by state-sponsored hackers. However, the alert is sent if Yahoo believes that a user is a suspect target and that they should take the necessary steps to protect their login credentials.
But really, the point of all this is none of this should matter, since the issue at hand is what are the contents of these emails. And so far, no DNC staffer has denied the authenticity of these emails. So even if Russia did leak them to WikiLeaks, Putin didn't write the emails. And we'll get more into this a little bit later in the show. More unanimous dissent is coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you. And we're still broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. Now, we ranted off the top of the show about the DNC email hack and the swirling reports of attribution for that hack, questions about whether Russians are involved in the hack and whether they're trying to influence U.S. elections. And I just wanted to make this point quick before we move on to a slightly different topic, and that is that while it is important to determine an attribution and figure out where these emails might have come from, it's not central to the discussion here. And that is the contents of these emails. Even if the Russians did leak them to WikiLeaks, Putin didn't write the emails. It wasn't Putin who suggested attacking Bernie because he's Jewish or because he might be an atheist. It wasn't the Russian government convincing DNC officials that they should remove their fingerprints before circulating articles critical of Bernie to other journalists. And it wasn't Putin wearing a Debbie Wasserman Schultz mask or posing as Debbie Wasserman Schultz online, calling Sanders' campaign ad Jeff Weaver a damn liar.
Nor was it Putin who set up such shambolic security, cybersecurity apparatus at the DNC. So.
Exactly. So as much as Clinton campaign manager Robbie Mook would like to make this all about Trump and Russia, it should be about what's actually in the emails. And I have a feeling there are more emails to come. That isn't to downplay the other potential news story of a foreign power trying to meddle in U.S. elections. If that's true, and I honestly wouldn't be surprised by it, I'm just waiting for actual evidence. If it is true, we should remember a few things. One, foreign powers meddling in elections is nothing new. And two, there are far more nefarious ways that foreign powers can hack U.S. elections than releasing internal emails that are genuine. Jack Goldsmith, a former Bush official in the Department of Justice, writes over at Lawfare blog, quote, "The possibilities do not end there. Foreign governments could, quote, hack a voting machine, shut down the voting system or election agencies, delete or change election records, hijack a candidate's website, dox a candidate." He adds, quote, "The Russian hack of the DNC was small beans compared to the destruction of the integrity of a national election result. Does the United States government have a well-worked-out plan to ensure that our highly computerized and highly decentralized system for electing the president is protected from foreign disruptions via cyber exploitation or cyber attack? I have no idea, but I seriously doubt it." And I doubt it too. And I'll note again, if people are so concerned about foreign influence on our elections, let's do something about vulnerable voting machines. You know, the ones that can be easily hacked and don't leave a paper trail. Those seem like they have to go. That is, of course, assuming that people do actually care about the security of our elections and aren't just running cover for the DNC. Just one last note here. Sanders supporters by the way, and activists in general have for 15 years now been warning about the vulnerabilities of voting machines to hackers, only to be rebuffed by the so-called responsible political class in America, who's calling them conspiracy theorists. The same people, by the way, who are today pushing conspiracies that the Russians are behind Emailgate in order to get Trump elected. So, anyways, I think we can move on briefly from that. I'm getting keyed up about the DNC, which is underway in Philadelphia. And I think that that stench from yesterday's official fart-in at the DNC has finally made it down to Washington, D.C. You smell that, Sam Knight? It's the smell of Democratic establishment corruption and lots of beans. Anyway, joining us now, who I can assure you is not responsible for the stench, is Rachel Curzius.
Thank you.
Have we waited for the minority report on this? We have dissenting opinions over here. Just kidding, Rachel. You smell nice.
Welcome back to the show, Rachel. You are the, as everyone knows by now, probably the associate editor at the DCist and the server of good content on Twitter.com under the handle of @curious_curz with a K. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. And just so that you know, this smell might be coming from the corpse flower, which has arrived in D.C. That's that huge flower that's actually made of a lot of little flowers. It is almost in peak bloom, and it smells like, and I quote from a botanist, a combination of garlic, fish, diapers, and rotting meat.
Oh, man.
So if you were wondering what that smell was...
Are they just growing around D.C. or something?
No, they're at the Botanic Gardens.
Okay. Oh, so you actually have to go out of your way to see the corpse.
Yeah, and smell it. And if you want to smell it, it only reeks at night.
Weird.
Cool, right?
Gosh, really nature weird. Is so weird sometimes. Anyway, last time we had you on...
Enough politics for now.
Right. Okay, so last time we had you on, you had this story for us about a cartoonist who lives here in Washington, D.C., who was squatting on several domains, website domains, in anticipation of Hillary Clinton picking her running mate. He had ClintonBiden.com, he had ClintonBooker.com, and he had the winning domain, ClintonCain.com. So are you here to tell us that our local cartoonist has cashed in big time?
I'm here to tell you that the local cartoonist, whose pen name is Jeremy Pegg, is hoping to cash out shortly. He's more than quadrupled his estimate of what he told me he was going to get for it. Now he thinks he's going to get $90,000.
Wow.
$90,000. Yeah, I found the one progressive in D.C. who's really excited about Tim King.
And this is off an investment that was like $10 or something,
yeah,
so and like $12 renewal fees.
Yeah,
he
spent $8 initially in 2011 on ClintonCain.com and has been Ooh. Sitting on it for Ooh. A good part of a decade, paying renewal fees annually of anywhere between $10 and $12. So if he does cash out, which he's hoping to do after the convention, mm-hmm. he'll make a very pretty penny.
Is it too late to jump into the 2020 game right now and start looking for domains like Trump Kanye 2020 or something?
Well, I don't know if this is Peg trying to misdirect everyone so he can score all the good domains, but he says cyber squatting is totally on the way out.
Oh,
he says that it's because nowadays, if you're interested in Clinton Kane, you don't type ClintonCain.com into the search. You just go to Google and search Clinton Kane.
Yeah.
So he says URLs are a lot less powerful and they're only decreasing in their power over time. That could just be clever misdirection so he can buy up Trump Kanye before you.
Yeah, I think that definitely is what it is.
Yeah, and he...
you have to question the motive.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Follow the money. He does still have Palenty 2012, and that one is still up for sale. He says he has not gotten any offers on it just yet, so...
Okay, well, let's get off domain squatting and talk about Tim Kaine himself.
Timonious Kaine of Hufflepuff. Yeah, let's do it.
So I know that you're a vocal supporter of fellow women having equal rights, including reproductive rights.
Yeah, reproductive justice, yeah.
Yeah, what do you make of Clinton team picking someone like Tim Kaine, who has a pretty spotty record on supporting women's right to choose?
Yeah, my main thought is...
How intersectional is it?
I found most fascinating about the rollout of Kaine as vice presidential nominee was how all of the pro-choice groups in Washington, D.C. responded to it, right? Planned Parenthood said he had an A yay, NARAL was really excited about it. And I think that what that shows is that these groups are, as Bernie Sanders said, establishment groups.
Remember when Bernie was, I don't want to say dragged through the dirt, but like heavily criticized.
Very much heavily criticized.
By liberals for saying that Planned Parenthood was part of the establishment.
Yeah, and Planned Parenthood is part of the establishment. That's not to say, I mean, and that just speaks to his record in the Senate. Kaine was also the governor of Virginia, under which a number of further regulations that are often called trap laws, meaning it doesn't stop you from getting an abortion. It just provides more barriers to make it more difficult for people to get an abortion, which means that people with less money, the barriers are even higher and higher. So the thing about Tim Kaine is...
And by the way, that was shot down recently, or reaffirmed, I should say, recently by the Supreme Court as unconstitutional, those barriers.
Some of those barriers were, and now it's very clear that Planned Parenthood is going after others of those barriers that exist in Virginia. There are pending lawsuits. The thing with someone like Tim Kaine is that, so he says he's Catholic. He is personally opposed to the right. He's personally opposed to abortion, but wants other people to have the right to choose. And that's the votes you see reflected in the Senate and in his sterling report card from Planned Parenthood. I think two things. The first is one of the things that Tim Kaine gets dragged on as far as reproductive justice advocates are on is that he didn't veto a license plate in Virginia that essentially was the right to life. And I've got to say, I think that's BS. I don't see what that really has much to do at all with his actual record. I think that that's a distraction, frankly. I don't see why people shouldn't have those kinds of license plates, especially if then you're going to open it up to allow people to have pro-choice or pro-abortion license plates. So I think that's a distraction from the major thing, which is that reproductive justice advocates and women in general are essentially told, you matter, we need you, you're so great. But when it actually comes to having full-throated advocates who aren't just willing to say, I feel really squeamish about abortion, but I guess you can have one, but actually are willing to litigate on the issues, who want to stand up for people's right to broaden their access, whereas Tim Kaine, for instance, is a supporter of the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment bans federal funding from being used for abortion. So I personally don't believe you can say that you are pro-choice if you are not allowing all women to have that choice.
And another thing about Kaine is that he was rumored to be one of President Obama's vice presidential picks back in 2008. And that was sort of the time where you start to see his metamorphosis from, you know, kind of a guy who has, you know, pro-life opinions to a guy who's like, well, I'll kind of put these pro-life opinions on hold because of my career. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. And I don't think that I think that that's something he shares with Joe Biden. Catholics who say that they are personally opposed to abortion, but want other people to have that right. And that's essentially what pro-choice should be, right? It doesn't matter if you would have an abortion. It matters that you want other people to have that choice.
Yeah.
What also seems problematic about the Kaine pick is that the Clinton campaign mercilessly attacked Bernie Sanders and his supporters as not representing the Democratic Party, that they're mostly white supporters.
Right.
And Kaine, of course, is white himself. You know, the Bernie bro meme that it's just a bunch of guys who support Sanders, even though a lot of young women supported Sanders and Kaine is a man. does his ability to speak fluent Spanish counteract all those concerns?
Oh my God. Ay Dios mío. Does this bug you guys as much as it bugs me? This idea that it doesn't matter what Tim Kaine says, as long as he says it in Spanish. That's absolutely bonkers to me. The fact that Julian Castro...
Ted Cruz speaks Spanish.
Does he really?
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Marco Rubio definitely speaks Spanish.
Yeah. I mean, and Tim Kaine speaks perfectly fine Spanish, but everyone is saying, oh, Julian Castro speaks bad Spanish. And like somehow him not speaking perfectly fluent Spanish is a mark against him. Whereas if Tim Kaine just says like, hola, amigos, everyone's like, +10 for Tim Kaine. What a wonderful guy. it just seems like, as in so many other things, he gets credit for being woke for just showing up.
It reminds me of how Republicans say that to defeat ISIS, we just need to name them radical Islamic extremists.
Yeah, and all their heads will just blow off.
I feel like the Clinton campaign is making a wager that to defeat Trump, we just need to speak a lot of Spanish.
I want to say something interesting about Tim Kaine's Spanish-speaking background. He was actually, I believe he was a missionary in Honduras. He's a Jesuit, and so he was a missionary in Honduras. And he went down there, I want to say, early 2015 with Senator John Cornyn on a security tour. And obviously Honduras is run by a military regime that is empowered, you know, but Hillary Clinton certainly supported that regime's consolidation of power when she, against the entire Organization of American States and the Obama administration, didn't want the restoration of Mel Zelaya. Anyway, I've gotten
down,
on a tangent here.
There.
But yeah, Tim Kaine was on that Honduras trip.
He was.
And engaging with the Honduran military and government.
Turning to Philly, now we've heard from Bernie Sanders on Monday, we heard from Elizabeth Warren, and we also had the fart in on Monday. What are you most looking forward to the rest of the week at the DNC?
In all seriousness, I'm fascinated to see Hillary Clinton make an affirmative case for candidacy. I've seen a lot of fear-mongering from establishment Democrats about how we need to defeat Trump. We absolutely need to defeat him. But I've seen far less of an explanation as to why we should vote for Hillary Clinton as opposed to why we should fear Donald Trump.
And that speaks to the Democratic Party in general, which has branded itself as the anti-Republican Party lately, rather than having its own ideals and pushing for a progressive agenda.
Yeah, it's and more we saw like, how well that worked out for the anti-Masonic Party. Not well.
Not well at all. We've got just about a minute left here, and we bring Rachel on once a week onto the show under this promise that if she talks about the important newsworthy stuff with us for the first 15 minutes, we can talk for the last minute about something that's pretty much nonsense. Okay, she'll disagree with this. I understand that the insane clown posse is invading Washington, D.C. soon.
Soon? It's actually September 2017, but I already put it in my calendar. At the gathering of the Juggalos this past weekend in Ohio, Violent J announced that there is going to be a march on Washington, D.C., September 2017, to protest the FBI's designation as Juggalos as a loosely affiliated gang.
Oh, man.
Consequences for that have included, for the Juggalos and Juggalettes, job loss, harassment by law enforcement, loss of child custody, et cetera. So this is an important issue that we're going to certainly be keeping an eye on, particularly given that the insane clown posse have you guys heard they like recently came out as evangelical Christians?
Really? That seems to be the natural like cycle of things, I feel like.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that by the time they come, they have this amazing video called Miracle, and a big part of it is magnets.
How do they work?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm hoping by September 2017 we'll have some answers.
Yes. Well, anybody not familiar with the band should look up all their hits from the 90s and also their latest saga, which involves government surveillance and government overstepping their bounds. And
it dovetails quite nicely with a lot of what y'all.
I was never an ICP fan, but I think they should delist the Juggalos.
I agree. Rachel Curzius, the associate editor over at the DCist, on Twitter @Curious_Curz. Thanks so much for coming on.
Sure, thanks for having me.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. Let's talk more about this DNC email hack, but you know what? I think we should do it in a more classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Now, at the center of the release of the DNC emails is WikiLeaks, which is loved by many,
reviled by many, and at least in the studio is regarded as meh. So the organization has done and does extremely important work. Its releases have been exceptionally valuable to reporters all around the world, including reporters in this room, and is still valuable to reporters, as we see with this latest DNC email hack. That's not to say that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange isn't open to criticism. He most certainly is. And the organization has made errors in the past, and it made errors releasing the DNC emails even by including personal donor information like social security numbers and credit card numbers. And in an article over at the Huffington Post on Monday, University of North Carolina professor Zeynep Tufekci blasted WikiLeaks for how it handled its recent release purporting to be emails belonging to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling political party. She notes that, quote, according to the collective searching capacity of long-term activists and journalists in Turkey, none of the Erdogan emails appear to be emails actually from Erdogan or his inner circle. Nobody seems to be able to find a smoking gun exposing people in positions of power and responsibility. This doesn't rule out something eventually emerging, but there have been several days of extensive searching. And she adds, quote, however, this dump does include massive databases containing sensitive and private information of millions of ordinary people, including a special database of almost all adult women in Turkey. So that is potentially problematic, especially when you now have a government that is going after lots and lots of people, like Erdogan's government is doing following that failed coup. And it's stuff like this which leads to WikiLeaks getting a bad rap, and rightfully so in some cases.
Yeah, they don't always do great things. But one thing important when discussing WikiLeaks is the marginalization of WikiLeaks in this country, despite or maybe because of its impact. And as we've said, it screws up sometimes. Assange isn't the most likable guy with the best opinions. WikiLeaks has done some very important work. Cablegate Publications, for example, they played a role in the Tunisian uprising, the one that led to the wider Arab Spring. Nonetheless, the website has been under secret federal criminal investigation since 2010 after it got its most explosive, damning, and impactful material from Chelsea Manning. Media reports at the time said the Justice Department was even seeking to indict Julian Assange as a co-conspirator with Manning under the Espionage Act, a law that sets Kafka-esque parameters on criminal proceedings.
Yeah, a law that Snowden won't come back because of it, because it doesn't allow him to make a whistleblower defense. And Chelsea Manning is serving a 35-year sentence for violating the law.
Yes, and so WikiLeaks is still under criminal investigation for this alleged conspiracy to publish classified information.
That was published by lots of other news outlets.
Yes, at least presumably so. We presume it's still under criminal investigation. The DOJ would only acknowledge the probe in 2014. It's being conducted, which is being conducted by the U.S. attorney in Alexandria before a grand jury, which, of course, those proceedings happen. They're non-public, to put it politically, politely, whatever. The Guardian reaffirmed last spring that the investigation was still open. Hopefully, media organizations should ask the DOJ again to confirm that it's still debating filing charges against WikiLeaks for the grave crime of embarrassing the U.S. government by publishing classified material, which, again, something newspapers and online publications do all the time, as is their right under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. But I'm not holding my breath. I barely see this ongoing creepy witch hunt mentioned whenever Assange or WikiLeaks is the topic in the national media. And people say they're afraid journalists will be singled out by Trump.
Yeah, that's the irony here. And remember, it wasn't just WikiLeaks that published Cablegate or any of these other stories. The Washington Post was involved. The New York Times was involved. The Guardian has published classified information as well. And none of these entities had the Department of Justice considered filing charges.
And I remember how Bill Keller, who was at the time, he was the editor of the New York Times, he said that Assange was a source, not a fellow journalist, when Assange was working with the New York Times to publish all these documents, Cablegate, etc. Keep in mind, Manning only went to WikiLeaks after the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Politico turned away the information that she was trying to bring them. So
Yeah.
Bill Keller, who's the real journalist now.
Yeah, Bill.
Another thing about WikiLeaks that merits discussion is that all of its disclosures that inconvenience the U.S. government are chilled by the state secret doctrine, state secrets doctrine, excuse me.
Which is?
So let me explain. U.S. officials are bound by law to refrain from openly discussing classified information, even when published. And this was something reaffirmed specifically about Cablegate in a 2011 executive order. Now, reading now from that EO, as they're called, classified information in the public domain remains classified and must be treated as such until such time it is declassified by an appropriate U.S. government authority. Contractors who had inadvertently discovered potentially classified information in the public domain shall report its existence immediately to their field security officers.
And we
know. See, I was laughing a little because it's a little absurd there.
Yeah, because there's a lot of classified information now in the public domain, thanks to the admirable work of a lot of whistleblowers who stepped forward. We've got the Cablegate, as you mentioned, and now Edward Snowden with the NSA. Leaks, now the DNC email hack. So it's a little strange that all this stuff is floating around in the public, yet it can't officially be recognized.
Right. I mean, this sort of directive might make sense if, for example, a contractor found something that was inadvertently placed in an FTP that could be publicly accessed.
Mm-hmm.
Then it would make sense, you know, stumbling upon. I get that. But yeah, Not things that have been in the national and global media for months.
Even members of the U.S. military, when they go online and are just browsing, I remember during the Snowden leaks in particular,
yeah,
newspapers, if you went online and read the news, they were all about what was in these leaks. And
yet
they censored every article about the leaks for people who were on U.S. military bases.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point to bring up, not just because it shows how
it puts our soldiers at a informational disadvantage. Exactly.
It does, actually. That's a very good point. And it shows a lot of disrespect for the rank and file. But what's more, I think what's more, well, maybe not more important, but certainly worth talking about on this subject is how WikiLeaks can be processed, analyzed, and sort of discussed by the chattering classes in this country. And for the record, we are definitely part of the chattering classes in this country.
Happily, yes.
Happily. But for example, a 2015 paper in the International Studies Quarterly, or ISQ, bemoaned, quote, political scientists have avoided using leaked information in their research. And now this abstract of this paper specifically cited Cablegate and leaks from TPP negotiations. And a Washington Post article on the story, on this sort of paper, and the discussion around it confirmed this gag effect, noting that researchers have every right to be worried about potential legal threats and the loss of institutional funding.
Not to mention the loss of future employment. You can get denied security clearances for openly flouting classification rules.
Yeah.
Unless you're an elite, in which case you can flout all the classification rules you want. Just make sure you're running for president.
Yeah. Just make sure you're politically connected. And by the way, I seem to remember, you know, James Comey, he was talking about Hillary Clinton's intent because, you know, let's be frank. This is what we're talking about. The email server. When James Comey was giving that remarkable press conference about why he wasn't recommending charges against Hillary Clinton, I believe one of the things he said was, you know, something to the effect of she's not intending to harm the United States.
Yeah.
Which is
they couldn't establish enough intent to determine that she meant to break the law, that it was just
but specifically to harm the United States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like this is very clearly something that is extraordinarily subjective.
Yes, and very difficult to prove.
Yeah. But anyway, moving on. Classified information is leaked all the time when it's convenient to the U.S. government. That information is often published by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Politico, and all the rest who rejected Chelsea Manning's entrees to get this hot information. So I think this is worth discussing. It's certainly worth reading what Julian Assange himself wrote on the matter in the 2015 book, The WikiLeaks Files. This closing of ranks within the scholarly class around the interests of the Pentagon and the State Department is in itself worthy of analysis. I certainly agree, but many pundits don't, unfortunately. I think that helps explain why people are so quick to run stories putting down WikiLeaks. I mean, both in terms of why people aren't willing to discuss the fact that there are these classification rules and these classification rules themselves.
Right. And let's just note that Assange himself has addressed the accusations that WikiLeaks is now allegedly operating on behalf of the Russian government. He's pointed out that his organization, in addition to publishing documents embarrassing to the U.S. government, has also published documents embarrassing to the Russian government, as well as allies of the Russian government, including Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And again, WikiLeaks is not the only outlet that received documents from the DNC hack. So too did The Hill, a pretty well-known news outlet that covers affairs on Capitol Hill. And so far, that outlet, The Hill, has been spared of charges that it too is operating on behalf of the Kremlin. Appearing on Democracy Now! This week, Assange made this point about those speculating on who the source of the DNC emails might be. He said, quote, A, we never reveal our sources, obviously. That's what we pride ourselves in. And we don't in this case either. But no one knows who our source is. It's simply speculation. It's, I think, interesting and acceptable to speculate who our sources are. But if we're talking about the DNC, there's a lot of consultants that have access, lots of programmers, and the DNC has been hacked dozens and dozens of times. Even according to its own reports, it had been hacked extensively over the last few years. And there was even a report by CNN on Monday that of the FBI warning the DNC months before news about this hack came out that it potentially was in danger of being hacked. And there was little action, as far as we know, by the DNC that was taken. And Assange, by the way, despite charges that he's doing the Kremlin's bidding to get Trump elected, didn't have nice things to say about Trump. He said choosing between Clinton and Trump is like choosing between cholera and gonorrhea.
Well, I don't know about you, Sam, but if I had to pick, I'd take gonorrhea 7 out of 7 days of the week.
I won't ask.
And I won't tell. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just wanted to say there's plenty of criticisms you could make about Julian Assange or WikiLeaks or, you know, the Russian government or any of these actors involved without resorting to spinning these crazy.
Yeah, let's make those criticisms once we've gone through the trove here and figured out what the documents actually
exactly
say.
Exactly. And I'm not willing to discount any scenario here, including a Russian hack. But let's be let's be cool on this certainty until we see hard evidence or evidence.
One last thing to wind this up. We have had a story over at the District Sentinel a few months ago about comments that James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, said before Congress in terms of throwing stones in glass houses. Congress was outraged about the OPM hack, which was alleged to be the Chinese government.
Yeah.
And Clapper was basically like, hold on, guys. This is intelligence operations that we do ourselves. Remember the old song about people in glass houses shouldn't be throwing rocks.
Right.
This seems to be another case of that, too.
Well, I just wanted to say one more thing. Well, bring up one more story here before closing out the classified session.
Sure.
You know, we've been talking all segment and all show, really, about how the national security state is, creepy.
Yeah, we're not even talking about them surveilling,
Right.
Picks. Can I say that? I think so.
I think you just did, buddy. But I want to highlight something it got right recently. It got correct. And this is from the Associated Press on Friday. The Pentagon has revised its law of war guidelines to remove wording that could permit U.S. military commanders to treat war correspondents as unprivileged belligerents if they think the journalists are sympathizing or cooperating with enemy forces. The amended manual published on Friday also drops wording that equated journalism with spying.
Wow.
So
pretty distressing that this stuff was in there to begin with, by the way.
Indeed, it very much was. But that it's gone, I think that's a good thing. I think that's a positive thing. It's no panacea. Our problems are not going to disappear overnight. But thank you very much, Pentagon, for no longer equating journalists you disagree with to spies and enemies. That is indeed very kind of you. Thank you as well to the AP, which noted that the changes were made in response to concerns expressed by news organizations, including the AP, who were afraid the revision would allow commanders to, quote, detain journalists for any number of perceived offenses. So on a happy note, that appears to have been rectified. So nice work over at the Pentagon for once. And now time for Devil's Advocate.
I agree with you, Bart.
What about both sides?
Well, you're only technically right.
Devil's Advocate.
So something we've been talking about on this show is the intersection of societal issues and Pokemon Go. Well,
that's that intersectionality that I crave, baby.
And we intend to continue that discussion today. According to news reports on Monday, the stock of Nintendo dropped precipitously on the Tokyo Stock Exchange by 17%, all because investors suddenly realized the company doesn't make the game. Reading now from The Guardian, quote, "The cause of Monday's decline was seemingly a statement put out by Nintendo after the close of trading on Friday, the day Pokemon Go was finally released in Japan. The statement pointed out that despite the long-running association of Nintendo with Pokemon, an association which seems to have driven investors' movements, it neither makes nor owns Pokemon Go. That fact was never hidden by any of the companies involved and has been noted in some reports on Pokemon Go, but the fact seems to have taken investors by surprise."
Oh my God, I love that last sentence. The fact was never hidden by any of the companies involved, but it still seems to have taken investors by surprise. This is actually good. I mean, obviously it's good. It's Devil's Advocate. I mean, I run the risk of violating the spirit of Devil's Advocate because I think this might actually be unironically good.
Why? What are some good reasons?
It's too good to not talk about. So here are some reasons why it's good. Number one, I'm personally vindicated. And anytime that happens, I like that. It proves my theory that Wall Street guys are all on cocaine and coked out of their minds 24/7. I mean, it doesn't prove it definitively, but it strongly suggests. So that's good. Number two, it shows economics 101 arguments about market forces and rational pricing is in fact insane. And number three, it proves that capitalism is doomed.
Yeah, all good points. I'm just glad that the potential Nintendo bubble has been stopped in its tracks for now.
Before it even started.
Before it blew up and we saw the cost of Mario bucks or whatever, coins you collect in Mario go through the roof.
Yeah, you got Goombas attacking Koopa Troopas over here trying to withdraw their coins from the question mark block.
That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today, folks. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. You can subscribe to this show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.